funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between money and influence in American politics, and how do even well-intentioned lawmakers end up at the beck and call of special interests? My guest today worries that the system we have siphons power away from the voters who actually put these leaders in office and believes all public elections should be paid for with public funding. Lawrence Lessig is professor of law and director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University. His new book is called Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Lawrence, welcome to Think.
Great to be here.
I want to start with what might sound to some people like a rhetorical question, but in fact is not. What tells you that the conventions of campaign finance and of lobbying that we have today are so out of hand?
I think the biggest signal is the extraordinary distortion of time that Congress demonstrates between issues that matter to the nation and issues that matter only to raising campaign funds. So if you asked last year in the first 4 months of the year what the number one issue that Congress spent its time working on, you know, in the middle of two wars, a huge unemployment problem, there was a debt ceiling crisis we were about to hit. So what was the issue they spent most of their time working on? It was the bank swipe fee controversy.
Matters a lot to banks.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But of course, as congressmen dance around on that issue, going from one side to the other, millions of dollars in campaign funds get dumped on top of their campaigns. So you begin to think, my gosh, their whole agenda of Congress is being driven by this question of what's going to get the most money into the system as opposed to what's going to address the questions that matter to America.
And it's a vicious cycle because the greater the sense that we as voters have that we're not really in control, the more likely we are to disengage from the democratic process ourselves.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when Rock the Vote, which turned out the largest number of young people in the last presidential election, 2010, was seeing a lot of their voters weren't going to turn out. So they asked them, what's the number one reason they weren't turning out? And by far, the number one reason was that people perceive that no matter what they do, money still will control the results. So, the rational response is, why waste your time? And so you need to have a belief that your vote is going to matter, and it doesn't matter if you believe that it's really money that's driving what Congress does.
And what's really insidious here, Lawrence, is that we are not talking for the most part about out-and-out bribery. Everything that is happening that we're discussing today is legal.
That's exactly right. And this is really the good news and the bad news. It's the good news because it shows how historically we've really addressed questions of corruption and dealt with them. You know, 100 years ago, the nation was disgusted to discover the extent of out-and-out bribery that was inside of our system. It's 99 years ago that we got rid of the appointed Senate because the Senate was such a source of corruption when it was just an appointed body by the states. So we rose up, we cleaned out at the federal level at least that kind of corruption, but it just invited this other more subtle and technically legal form of corruption, which is much more pervasive and I think ultimately much more harmful because it's out in the open, nobody doubts it, people are proud to live by the rules, but the effect is the same. It's special interests that get to buy their influence by deploying resources through the system.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of lobbying. Today, this is considered, for the most part, a respectable profession. That was not always the case. How has lobbying changed over the past century and a half?
Well, I think it goes hand in hand with the change in the regulations controlling what Congress does. So when Congress wasn't policing itself about bribery, indeed, bribery wasn't even a crime in Congress until 1856, when, you know, you could basically get away with anything, and people did get away with anything. In that world, lobbyists tried to help them get away with what they could and get for their clients what they wanted. So lobbyists were, little more than suppliers of every kind of vice that was necessary to get congressmen to do what congressmen what they wanted their congressmen to do. Today, that's a completely different system. You know, lobbyists are decent, honest, hardworking people, very intelligent and knowledgeable about what they're working on. But because they're in the middle of the campaign fundraising business, as well as in the middle of providing information to Congress, that produces this invidious influence that begins to make it so that they are at the center of the kind of corruption that I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's sort of ironic then when lobbying was blatantly corrupt, it's self-limiting to a certain extent.
Yeah, there's still shame in the system. So you have to be a little bit limited and keep things underground, and people have to make sure that you're not seen as an out-and-out crook. But now there's no shame. Everybody's open and honest and completely forthcoming about the behavior they're engaging in. The problem is people inside of Washington don't call it corruption when the whole point of my book is to make it absolutely clear it is a corruption of the system, and that's just as invidious as a corruption of the individuals in the system.
What sort of funding does it take to mount a successful campaign for Congress?
Well, that depends a little bit about whether you're taking on an incumbent or you're in an open seat. If you're taking on incumbent, unless there's been some scandal, it's practically impossible to imagine prevailing because the incumbents have such an advantage in funding going in, and they have such an advantage in the connections they need to outside funders going in. But, you know, it's probably, on average, the cost of the winning campaigns between $1 and $1.5 million right now. Depends, very different depending on what part of the country. But that's an extremely high, a large amount of money for anybody to be able to raise and put in unless they write it from their own checkbook.
Yeah, and it's interesting that incumbents have extraordinary advantage over their challengers, not so much because voters are familiar with them, but because, once again, they have the money.
Yeah, and the connection. So, you know, you're an incumbent. You've spent 2 or 6 years in the business of sewing up the connections you need with the suppliers of campaign funds, mainly lobbyists, so that everybody knows going into the election, you've got the back is covered. And so when that threat comes along in the form of a challenger, people know exactly where they need to turn in order to get the support they need to win.
I have to tell you, I was astonished to read about the amount of time and energy that our elected officials spend just bringing in money for their campaigns. Can you tell us about what you learned?
Yeah, so we don't have a lot of great data about this. I looked at every single study that tried to estimate, and what I found was estimates of between 30 and 70% of the time of a member's job is spent in the business of raising funds to get back to Congress or to get their party back into power. And, you know, just as the technical employers of Congress, which we all are, you know, we should be a little bit outraged that our employees are spending so much time not on the job we hired them for, but on the job of trying to make sure that they're going to get a job again the next time around. So, you know, I think that just at that simplest level, we've got to look at the system and say, this is a complete waste of our time and resources, and we need to do something to make it a much more effective system responsive to we the people.
Well, and it's so funny because we have all these regulations about, you know, you can't use the phone that the taxpayers pay for to raise money. Maybe we'd be better off saying you can't spend more than an hour a day bringing in cash for your reelection.
That's a really brilliant idea. And that, of course, would force them then to begin to bring about the kind of solutions that I'm talking about.
What sort of access do large donations buy that is not typically available to average voters who simply call and ask for an audience with their member of Congress?
Yeah. So you call and ask for an audience, you're not going to get one until they've checked to verify what kind of supporter you've been. And if you've not been a supporter at all, then, you know, it's basically impossible. There have been some congressmen who've actually specified what the level of contributions have to be to get an audience with your member of Congress. You know, some people who aren't embarrassed by the system at all are quite willing to be open. You know, you've got to max out, then you can get an audience with a member. Typically, it's the lobbyists who get access, and the lobbyists like that, of course, because that means you got to pay lobbyists to get access. And the members like that because the lobbyists become much more reliable funders for members and their campaigns. So you've got to sign a retainer agreement with lobbying firm to get your interest out there before the congressman. And that, of course, is the kind of money which all but, well, certainly the 99% don't have on the table to hand over.
And certainly, to some extent, it makes sense that elected leaders cannot see everybody who wants to see them. I mean, there are people with all kinds of concerns and complaints. It just seems like there's got to be a better way, petitions or something, to have someone be able to get in and talk face-to-face with a congressional rep or a senator.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of different ways we could make that decision. It just seems outrageous that the way we make that decision is on the basis of who gives the most money in a campaign. You know, that seems the least legitimate. There's plenty of, you know, even if it were something as crude as you're from my party or you helped organize, you know, the people who turned out the vote on election day. Those would be legitimate in a system where power is to be measured in votes cast on an election day. But this is not a system where power is supposed to be measured by who gives the most money in campaigns. That's not the Republic.
What sort of effectiveness do you say letter-writing campaigns or these calls to barrage your representative with telephone calls expressing your position on an issue have as compared with the influence of lobbyists?
Well, these are often aimed at different things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes, like right now, we're in the middle of this huge battle over something called SOPA, which is the Stop Online Piracy Act, which many in the technology community and many other sensible souls are terrified is going to be a radical change in the way the Internet is regulated. And it's being pushed by the copyright industries. And the copyright industries, of course, have lots and lots of money that they're putting into campaigns. So there you have a fight between the kind of grassroots movement, and there's literally hundreds of thousands of people who've participated in fighting against this bill, versus the lobbyists. But those are rare. Usually the lobbyists are operating, you know, in the caverns, way underground. You know, so they're worried about the tiny little changes in tax code that nobody's paying attention to, but will produce $10 million additional profit for their clients. So there, I cite in my book all sorts of examples of studies that have looked at these changes in tax codes and changes in tiny regulations affecting companies that have produced hundreds, even thousands, tens of thousands return on investment for the company that hired the lobbyist. You know, they spend $1,000 and they get $1 million from the change in law. And that's mainly where the lobbyists are working. If the issue gets to a place where you've got, you know, the grassroots really angry about it, then the lobbyist isn't really happy because maybe he'll win or maybe she won't win. But it's the kind of fight that they like to avoid.
And, of course, very often lobbyists are able to get in and get out and get their things done because they are not talking about things that make much sense to the average voter.
Yeah, it's too complicated. It's an obscure area of regulation. You know, when you've got a huge government that regulates as widely as this government regulates, there's lots of tiny crevices where this influence can begin to be inserted. And the lobbyists become these entrepreneurs, these innovators who are, you know, trying to find every new place they can to insert their influence and therefore trade it for cash with their clients.
We should stipulate here that your sense is that both parties are sort of equally corrupted by the system we have.
Absolutely. There's no pure soul in this system. And that's, you know, it's an important point about what the remedy needs to look like. It's not going to be something solved, I think, by the inside alone, because the inside depends so much on this system continuing. It's really going to take outsiders who don't want to become, you know, they're not politicians wannabes, but they're citizens who are trying to push for the kind of change that we need in this system.
My guest is Lawrence Lessig. He's professor of law and director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University. His new book is called Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also submit email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Professor of Law and Director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University, Lawrence Lessig. His new book is called Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Lawrence, people might argue, look, anybody with a particular interest can set up a lobby, whether that's a trade group or some kind of nonprofit collaborative. How do we know that the ones with the largest bank rolls tend to do better than the ones working on a shoestring?
Well, you can't say always that the ones with the large bank rolls win. Sometimes the shoestring wins. And nothing I'm trying to argue is about talking or predicting much about the results. What mm-hmm. I'm pointing to is what we can tell about the way it changes the attention of Congress in doing their work. So the framers wanted a Congress, quote, dependent upon the people alone. That's what the Federalist 52 says. That's the conception of their democracy. But what we have is a Congress, if they're spending 30 to 70% of their time raising money, who've developed a dependency not on the people alone. There's a second dependency there that conflicts with the dependency that would exist if they were dependent on the people alone. So that's all I wanted to establish to get to this conclusion that the system in this sense has been corrupted relative to what they said. And then you can stand back and you can say, well, okay, it's a corrupted system. Do I like the results from this system or not? I don't actually know anybody who would say that he or she does like the results from the system. But even if you like the results from the system, it doesn't change the fact that the system is corrupt.
So what you're proposing here is setting up a campaign funding system where the money comes in, relative to what we have now, very small amounts, only from individual voters.
That's right. So the problem, if the problem is you've got a Congress dependent upon its funders, but its funders are a tiny slice of the American people, right? So 0.26% of Americans give more than $200 in a congressional campaign. 0.05% of Americans give the maximum amount in a congressional campaign. So, you know, the Occupy Wall Street people are proud of their 99 versus 1% slogan. It's bad marketing. They would be talking about the 99.95% of Americans who don't have the influence that the 0.05% of Americans have, because they're the ones giving the money in these campaigns. So that is the problem with the system, that it's dependent upon a tiny slice of Americans. Well, if that's the problem, the solution is to create a funding system where we the people are the funders. And so the way to do that I described, there's a couple of proposals out there, but the one that I'm describing here says, let's take the first $50 that all of us pay in taxes and rebate it in the form of a democracy voucher. And with that voucher, you can give any part of that voucher to any candidate who agrees to fund his or her campaign with democracy vouchers plus contributions of regular cash up to $100, so that nobody... practically anybody in our system can afford $100, and they all would have a democracy voucher. And candidates who opt into this system then would be funding their campaigns with small dollar contributions only, so nobody could believe that they were making decisions based on the money as opposed to on what they believe was right.
Of course, we have an option now for presidential candidates, for example, to take only public funding, and nobody seems to want to do that.
Yeah, that's a very different system. So, yeah, we can each of us gets to check off whether we're going to contribute $3 to the presidential system. But that system, the government decides basically how much each candidate is going to get based on some elaborate calculation that the FEC makes. And what Obama said when he ran this last time is that amount of money just wasn't going to be enough, and so he was going to opt out of that system. In the system I'm describing, there's no government bureaucrat that's deciding who gets what. It's all of us with our vouchers who decide how we're going to allocate the vouchers to give candidates what we believe they're entitled to. And if the numbers are right, then candidates will opt into it. So in Connecticut, which adopted not the exact system I'm describing, but another system for funding elections with small dollar contributions only, 80% of the elected officials opted into that system in the first year, 80%. So, you know, if we had a system where even just 70% of congressmen opted into this way of funding elections in the first year, we'd have a system where, you know, we could begin to believe again that it was not money that was driving results.
We have an email here from Paul T. in Dallas who writes, if our elected officials were limited to a single eight-year term, one quarter of them elected every 2 years, then re-election money, campaigning, etc. would all become moot points. One also couldn't buy influence because one is not needed for re-election.
That's true. I think I've, and I used to be a strong supporter of campaign limits. Here are the two problems, I think, with it. Term limits are the system in California. And what I found out when I spent just about a decade in California is what they produce is a system where the only people who know how to do anything are the lobbyists,
mm-hmm.
because they're the only ones who have the experience enough to know how to run things. But the second system, this particular proposal you described, is not quite as vulnerable to that criticism, because 8 years is a long time. You could figure it out in 8 years. But the second part to it is that, you know, the point of a democracy, the point of having a House that's elected every 2 years, is to make sure that the government stays close to the concerns of the people. The framers were very proud that it was a very quick cycle to force the House to go back to the people to get continued support from the people. And if you say we're going to elect them for 8 years and they don't have to pay attention to us for almost a decade, then I think I would fear that they would just steer off in a direction that was going to answer the people who are going to hire them after their eight-year term and not to continue to worry about keeping faith with the people.
Let's talk about that hiring after the eight-year term. For the most part, when you have members of Congress and even their staffs, when they are finished serving on Capitol Hill, they stay on Capitol Hill but jump over into the lobbying side.
That's right. Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee, described it for me by saying Capitol Hill has become a kind of farm league for K Street, of course, where all the lobbyists live.
Mm-hmm.
So it's importantly not just the members, it's the staffers. This becomes the business model of being a congressional staffer. You go there, you do your hard, interesting work on the Hill, and then you step off the Hill and you make the money you need to, you know, buy your house or pay for your kids' education.
Like prosecutors becoming private defenders.
Yeah, that's right. But the difference here is that the prosecutors can't really trade their office or influence while they're prosecutors in any effective way for the benefit of the law firm they're going to go be hired to. I mean, it's possible in particular cases, and that's dealt with corruption law, but not systematically. Here, Jack Abramoff has a fantastic book called Capital Punishment, and he describes the most effective technique that he as a lobbyist practiced was to basically signal to a staffer that the staffer would have a job at his firm when he left the Hill. And as Jack said, from the moment of that discussion, I owned that staffer, and I didn't have to pay him a penny. And whatever I wanted, that staffer would do for the whole time that he was working for a member of Congress. So this system is a system where you can systematically corrupt what happens on Capitol Hill just by the very opportunity of being able to hire these people after they leave Capitol Hill.
And it's important to talk about the staffers, because I think, you know, as members of the public, if we haven't had direct experience, you don't realize how much influence those staff members have on the voting member of Congress or the Senate.
Yeah, well, if members are spending 30 to 70% of their time on the phone raising money, then obviously much of their work has got to be done by their staff. And staff become critical, and there's a million things staffers can do to affect the direction of a bill or to block a bill or to change subtly what a bill does, and they do. And, you know, there have been some pretty famous examples of staffers inserting something into a bill and then jumping off right when it's passed and cashing out at some lobbyist that was benefited from that change. And that's, you know, just a picture of how important and influential these staffers can become. And another reason to be so concerned about any business model which allows them to step from being staffer into being a lobbyyist. Now, one very important thing to keep in mind is that it hasn't always been like this with lobbyists and staffers. One of the most surprising statistics I found in doing research for this book was that in 1972, the average salary of a staffer was the same as an average salary of a lobbyist. So, you know, there was no desire to go from being a staffer to being a lobbyist. You know, it was more interesting to be on the Hill actually doing the work and changing policy rather than arguing to people about why policy should be changed. But it's because lobbying has become such a lucrative business that they can begin to offer the salaries to the staffers that make it so the staffers are focused on their life as lobbyists. and therefore sets up the conditions in which this kind of corruption can happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Jean in Dallas. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I have lobbied. In fact, I was a lobbyist in Washington and around the world all through the 90s. I represented businesses. I came from a Democratic perspective, but certainly lobbied on both sides of the aisle. Subsequently, I haven't lobbied professionally, but I have done a lot of private, not-for-profit work in that endeavor. And while I don't disagree with the majority of what your guest is saying with regard to the way money can corrupt the system, I just want to caution him to not be as extreme as he was when he stated that if you are a member of a, if you live in a district of a congressman, there is no way you are going to be able to see that congressman unless you have donated or gone through a lobbyist. I just think that that kind of inaccurate, extravagant statement calls into question a lot of the other facts that I agree with that he is making. And more specifically, I would say any member of Congress in the House of Representatives who lives in the voting district has the ability to call that office, and if they can't get an appointment with at least a legislative assistant, then they simply haven't talked to their person well enough. And the reason for that is because while congressmen are in fact motivated by money, they are also ultimately seeking votes, and knowing that you are a vote in the district carries a lot of weight. Additionally, positioning through press, through petitions, through some of the things you mentioned, but essentially just having a good story in the paper can get the attention of a legislative assistant that, as you just said, has a great deal of influence on the congressman.
Jean, thank you so much for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Lawrence?
Yeah, it's a great point. And you know, I tell the story in the book about a woman who was organizing a meeting with really the leading woman on child health care issues in the country. And she, they had a meeting there, had about 12 people that were going to go talk to members of Congress, members in the Senate, had called and called and called to these members of the Senate to talk about setting up one of these meetings. And they'd been strung along, maybe, and the night before these things were to happen, nobody would open their doors. And then she, who is a very wealthy woman from Los Angeles, one of the most influential people in Los Angeles, picks up the phone and calls the financing directors. And the finance director, within a couple hours, had opened the doors to seven of these senators. And the meetings happened with seven of these senators. Now, I think the caller's perspective is really a very valuable one, because I absolutely don't want to be heard to say only money matters. Absolutely right. There are lots of times that I'm sure members of Congress sitting in their office, somebody knocks on the door, say, can I talk to you? They say, sure, come on in, talk to me, that's fine. So I'm not saying that there's a ticket, but I am saying, first of all, there are in fact members of Congress who have said how much they charge for you to get a meeting, number one. And number two, money does channel an extraordinary amount of how much access you're going to be able to get inside of the system. That alone, I think, is the reason to be concerned. It's not that, you know, if it's 20% or 40% or 60%, it's a percentage that's higher than it should be. We shouldn't have a system where access is being driven by money. And in some cases, it is so extreme that I think anybody, including the caller, would think it's an outrage to the system.
We have an email here from Bruce in Coppell who writes, if money is free speech, as the Supreme Court has ruled, then does it not follow that someone who has more money than I have also has more free speech than I have?
In a very important sense, yes. And the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this area has made it pretty hard to think about a lot of reforms that people have been pushing for a long time. Now, the particular proposal that I talked about, you know, for setting up public funding through a voucher program that people got to use to support candidates of their choice, doesn't conflict with that Supreme Court principle, because in addition to free speech, money being free speech, candidates also have a free speech right to choose what kind of contributions they're going to accept. So there's no constitutional problem if a candidate says, I'm only going to take $100 contributions, or I'm only going to take $100 contributions plus voucher contributions. That's their right as much as it's my right to spend my money to speak freely.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey there. You know, one of the things that's a big head-scratcher for me is that, you know, watching year after year the amount of money that is being spent, either, you know, through direct contributions to individuals or predominantly through the ideas of super PACs, et cetera. You know, there's no doubt that, that issues are becoming more contentious. The money that's being spent is making these issues and the competing ideologies behind them much more prevalent in the media. And so it makes our voting, in my opinion, at least much more contentious. But, you know, what really confuses me is that throughout all of the money spending and throughout all of the heightening of the rhetoric and the vitriol, we still have an embarrassingly low percentage of people who actually get out and vote. And so it's an interesting correlation that doesn't exist to me. I would hope to see that, if nothing else, even though I disagree with the idea of all of this extra money that's being spent, I would love to see that that also produces a higher percentage of people who actually, you know, get off of their seats and go and vote, and yet we don't see that. Any comment?
It's a great point. And I talk about this research in the book, which is at first a little bit counterintuitive. We have the sense of America as very polarized, and the research actually shows that America is not at all polarized. If you look at the attitudes of Americans, it's perfectly normally distributed. What's polarized are the politically active Americans, a small subset of America.
Hmm.
And the small subset of America, politically active, are increasingly polarized, more polarized than we have been since the Civil War. So that small subset of America that is polarized gets even more polarized because fundraising is easier if you speak to the extremes. So if you're on the left, you raise money easier if you are more extreme to the left. And if you're on the right, you raise money more easily if you are more extreme to the right. So the very act of fundraising and driving this system of funding the way that we do pushes these politically active people more to the extremes. And what that does to the rest of us is leave the rest of us more and more turned off with the system. So most of us are not polarized, but most of us are outraged and don't even recognize the kind of political opinions we see, whether it's on Fox or on MSNBC. And so most of us just say, this isn't for me. I just come from a different planet, and we just stay home. Hmm. So in 2010, there was only 40% of registered voters who turned out to vote. And that, of course, is even a subset of the people who could vote if they actually went out and registered.
Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. My guest is Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Harvard University. His new book is Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Lawrence Lessig, who is director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University and author of the new book, Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. The telephone number here is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Before the break, Lawrence, you were telling us about this perceived political polarization of the United States, which turns out to be only a factor among the most politically active among us. And you were saying that in 2010, only 40% of voters actually turned up at the polls?
Yeah, that's right. And so in that 40% of total registered voters, of course, is an even smaller fraction of total people who would be able to vote. And strikingly, 40% of that 40% were people who identified themselves as Tea Party members, even though the Tea Party overall in the representative of the overall population is a much smaller segment. So these are people who are very active to turn out, and they do turn out, and they obviously had a very significant influence on the ultimate results, but largely because there's a whole bunch of other people out there who are either so turned off or so convinced that there's no reason to get engaged that they don't even show up.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Martin in Fort Worth. Hi, Martin.
Yes, hello.
I go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I would like to know if Lawrence Lessig has any thoughts on the Supreme Court going forward after Citizens United and all the money that's been unleashed via the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, and all of these other right-wing conservative groups that are really advocating for, you know, lots of money into politics, if he thinks there could be any kind of retrenchment by the court to rethink anything that they've done. And second, I'd like to know if he can recommend a copy of the Federalist Papers to me.
Well, the second one's pretty easy. You can get a free copy of the Federalist Papers on Google Books if you just go to books.google.com. There's a whole bunch that you can download to your computer for free that are available. And, there's a whole ton of resources there I'd recommend. As to the first one, yeah, this is a huge problem. The Supreme Court in Citizens United basically said that both corporations and individuals have an unlimited right to spend as much money as they want on promoting or opposing any political candidate. And that has radically changed the business of campaigns, especially because of the rise of something called super PACs, which have been allowed to be structured so that even the contributors to these super PACs can be effectively anonymous. So you can have hundreds of millions of dollars in a super PAC given by who knows who. They can have all of these completely innocuous names, Americans for Prosperity, that go and actually are the fundamental drivers in elections. And we're seeing this in the presidential election. In New Hampshire, John Huntsman's super PAC spent millions in television ads, and his actual campaign spent less than $100,000 in television ads. Supposedly, the super PACs are independent of the campaigns, but when you have the super PACs funded by relatives and managed by former campaign executives, it's impossible to believe these are really independent entities. So these have become the real actors in the system. And the thing to fear is that the only way you as a candidate or an incumbent can buy insurance against the attack of another super PAC is to sidle up to a super PAC on your own side in advance. And you sidle up and you buy protection by basically signaling to that super PAC how you're going to vote the way that super PAC wants you to vote. So therefore, super PACs have become the most powerful influence in this election system by far, and it's really the product of a terrible decision by the Supreme Court. John McCain, somebody who I don't often agree with, but John McCain says it was the worst decision of the Supreme Court in 50 years. That just might be right.
The way you describe this, Lawrence, it almost sounds like street gangs and the way they operate in little corners of the urban jungle.
Yeah, it is exactly like street gangs. Not as much violence in the overt sense, but certainly power being exercised in a very similar way.
So let's assume that a great majority of American voters think this is a good idea. How do we actually make it happen?
Well, I think that the first step is that we've got to make this an issue in the campaign. You know, the most striking thing about this current presidential fight is that in the mainstream political battle, you know, in the Republican Party, for example, right now, this issue is completely invisible. The only candidate who even mentioned the issue, he made it central to his campaign, Buddy Romer, a former governor from Louisiana, four-term congressman, was never even allowed to be on stage in any of the debates to make this point about the corrupting influence of money inside of our system. Every other candidate on that stage depends heavily on the super PACs and the large contributions, and they would all be hypocrites if they even raised the issue and talked about it. And of course, Barack Obama, who came to power with the small dollar contributions that funded his last campaign, is not going to get elected by the small reelected by the small dollar contributions. He's out there raising at $35,000 a pop, as much money as he possibly can, and he'll have his own super PACs on his side. So the first thing we as citizens can do is to begin to force the regular candidates to talk about this issue and to take a stand on it. And that means every single congressperson that you hear speak when you go to a town hall meeting, you raise this issue first and you say, what are you doing to end the corrupting influence of money in Washington? And it's only when the politicians begin to feel the pressure around this issue that they'll begin to look for a plausible solution to address it. There are a lot of organizations that are trying to rally people around this. Common Cause has been doing this forever. There's a new group called UnitedRepublic.org. I run a small group that's inspired by Henry David Thoreau's quote, for every thousand hacking at the branches of evil, there's one striking at the root. And we, of course, believe the root here is the money. So we call ourselves root strikers. I was on Jon Stewart's show. He thought we should call ourselves Batman instead. But whatever, Batman or root strikers. Our job is to try to get people to recognize the connection between money and politics. So they increasingly demand that their politicians address it. That's the only way this system is going
to
change.
Just to go back for a second so we don't risk leaving people with the wrong impression, the reason Buddy Romer was not on stage at those debates had to do with the amount of support that he had been demonstrated to have via things like petitions and campaign signatures. Is that correct? It wasn't because of his position on campaign finance.
You're right, not directly, although indirectly, certainly, because, you know, Buddy Romer took a pledge that he would take no more than $100 from anybody to fund his campaign. No PAC money, everything would be disclosed. In the first debate, the question was, have you received 1% of national poll recognition? And, you know, he had been out of politics for more than a decade. He's running a community bank, so, you know, he's not recognized nationally the way he was 20 years ago. Then it was 2%. After he met the 1%, the standard was 2%. And then after he met the 2%, the standard was, have you raised $500,000 in the previous 6 weeks? And, you know, and his response was, wait a minute, my whole point is about the corrupting influence of money. If I raised $500,000 in previous 6 weeks and the way everybody else is raising this money, I would be in the same corrupting game that they're in. And that's exactly the game that I want to attack. So if he had, you know, sold his principles and done it the way everybody else had done it, then he could have been on stage, but then he wouldn't have been able to attack the system the way he wanted to attack the system. So I agree. Nobody said, you know, we're blocking you because you are not, because you want to attack the role of money in politics. But it is a little astonishing that the guy who had the most experience, you know, he had more experience in government than any other candidate, 4 terms in Congress, 1 term as a governor, plus 15 years running a bank. That guy was excluded from the debates, even though people like, you know, Kane, who had no government experience, was invited again and again.
We have an email here from Mundy who writes, I believe we should have a publicly funded system, but if you're giving people vouchers for the first $50 in taxes they pay, what about the people who don't pay taxes? I, for example, am a stay-at-home mom. There are also the unemployed.
Yeah, so it's true that only about 53% of people pay income taxes. But in fact, and I document this in the book, in fact, almost all of us, you know, 97 or 98% of us pay some form of taxes to the federal government, whether it's cigarette taxes or payroll taxes or Social Security tax. You pick it. We pay taxes to the federal government. Now, you might, you know, it's certainly true that there's a tiny slice of us who don't pay anything. And again, I'm not talking about what on net we pay. I'm just talking about the fact that we do put money into the system.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying, if it's really true that, you know, 97% of us are in effect paying money into the system, then let's just simplify it and say, okay, everybody who wants to register to vote can get a democracy voucher to help fund the system so that we have a system funded in a way that we could trust.
Paul in Farmers Branch wants to know if you can comment on Americans Elect, the internet-based populist effort to select a president and vice presidential nominee to appear on the ballot in most states in the November election.
Yeah, I would say actually that team is going to be on the ballot in every state. I'm actually a non-compensated advisor to Americans Elect, And I actually think that it could be a pretty important factor in this election, and a good one if the Americans Elect candidates are reformers. I don't actually believe that what we need is, you know, one more choice that's somewhere between the Republican and the Democrat. I don't think that's actually the problem. I think we need a choice who's going to make reform the issue. And so I think that we actually see a number of people lining up to try to become the Americans Elect candidate who would make reform the central issue. And if they do that, I think this could be quite an interesting election because, you know, as much support as Mitt Romney is getting right now, there's a significant number of people in the base of the Republican Party who are not going to be excited by him. And I think even though I was a supporter of Barack Obama in the last election, there's a significant number of people who have been disappointed by his unwillingness to carry through and his promise of change who would be open to thinking about an independent candidate who actually wants to make fixing the system his or her number one priority.
Why do you think that President Obama has not followed through on those campaign promises to change the way money works in American politics? I mean, I would imagine his argument would be, I've been busy with other things, but what do you think is the reason?
I actually had a chance to talk to some of the people inside the administration. They had no plan for how they were going to do this. It was very attractive rhetoric, and about, in April of the year before the election, April of 2008, it was kind of the dominant rhetoric, and it made it clear why Obama would be a different candidate from Hillary Clinton. But if you remember, once Hillary Clinton stepped out of the race, most of the people from her campaign, and certainly the administration people, joined the Obama administration. So the administration was filled with people, not all of whom thought reform was the job, and they just had no plan going into it about how they were going to bring reform about. I was told one story of, when Obama was given his first budget, there were something like 7,000 earmarks in that budget, and Obama supposedly said, I want to veto this. But his lobbyists from the Hill told him he could not veto that, could not turn his back on the Democrats. And I just think if he had vetoed that and if he had made that his first stand in this fight to change the way Washington works, there would be enormous amount of energy supporting what he's doing now that right now is just very disappointed.
Do you have any sense, Lawrence, that if we were able to make a system like this work where we had the $50 vouchers and then contributions to individual candidates limited to $100 a person, would, if everyone went along with it, would most of the veterans right now, the incumbents in Congress, be happy to get off the crazy carousel of fundraising and do it this way?
Yeah, I think they do. I think they would be much happier. They could feel much better about themselves. They could feel like what they were doing is based on what they believe, whether they believe something on the right or on the left, and not spending so much of their time pandering to these money suppliers. And that's even more when you think about the super PACs, where they're so vulnerable to super PACs right now that they're constantly trying to line up support on their own side, and that must really turn the job of being one of our leaders into a very, very almost embarrassing kind of position. So yes, I absolutely believe they would like the system better. But like all of us, they're afraid to change because they won under the current system and they don't know if they could win under the new system. And some of them, are very eager to continue life after their life in Congress as lobbyists. And if we had this different system, lobbying would still survive. I think lobbyists are an essential part of the system. But as John Edwards used to say when we used to quote John Edwards, there's all the difference in the world between making an argument to a jury and handing $100 bills out to our jurors. That's the distinction lobbyists in Washington don't understand right now.
Lawrence Lessig is professor of law and director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University. His new book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Lawrence, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.